This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
I'm Helen Farmer. This is the Afternoons with Me podcast. Today we are talking about being child-free by choice. Inundated with messages from people who have made this decision, and also talking about the financial barriers to people starting or indeed growing their family. Kuya J was in the studio, as was Shadow Filio, giving her perspective on being child-free by choice. Plus, do you know what a dinkwad is? You will by the end of this. We were also exploring this idea of healthcare versus sick care. Joining us from TVM Capital Healthcare, we had the chairman, Dr. Helmut Schüssler, exploring what we can do to stay healthy for as long as possible. What are the pillars and what does he believe is the most important one? Plus, we were exploring nurseries too. How do you make the right decision when there's so many in Dubai, from curriculum to location? We were joined in the studio by an area manager and a mum. Plus, it was Kids Coach Gigi on hand as we discussed transitions, whether it's tiny toddlers going to nursery for the first time or indeed leaving the country. That really valuable discussion if this is something that you're worried about. Special guest with us this afternoon to discuss an increasingly common decision amongst many couples and individuals choosing not to have children for financial reasons. Rising costs of living, childcare, this choice is becoming increasingly prevalent and we are seeing lower populations in some countries as a result of it. We're going to be delving into various factors influencing this decision, both external and internal, and exploring some personal experiences and studies relating to financial responsibility and planning. And then later in the show, we are talking about being child-free by choice. Is that you, regardless of finances? Has having kids never really been on your radar at all? Joining us in studio, J. Adrian Tolentino. He's a financial educator, specialises in the Filipino community in particular, but is on hand to help us out, offering his insights. He's also a new dad. How are you, Jay?
Hi, Helen. So excited to be here.
This topic is right up your jabal alley because it's kind of timely, but it's also timeless because people have historically worried about how am I going to afford to have children? How am I going to afford to have more children. So also, I think that's such a personal choice of how many children do we want to have and why. So, for example, I'm one of two kids. My husband's one of two kids. That felt like that, you know, that was probably where we'd end up settling. If we had unlimited funds and help, and I felt like I could give my children equal attention and love and care, I could be tempted.
I'm not going to.
Because I do not have unlimited funds or unlimited help. I could. But the decision to go from two to three kids is massive.
Yeah.
Especially when you get to school age and especially start looking at flights.
Lots of things you can consider.
Cars.
Exactly.
You know, all of that. Now, you're a recent dad.
Yeah.
If it's not too personal a question, what kind of questions were you and your wife asking yourselves before the decision to start a family?
Well, personally, when I was single, I never really wanted to have a child. Because of the same reason, it is expensive to have kids. It is a fact. And when I got married, I knew for a fact that we will be having kids because my wife wanted to have kids. And I love my wife. And then this was the time that I'm also enjoying challenges of life. I've experienced so many difficult things. And I thought that, yeah, why not become a dad? It's part of my what if questions in life.
What are the what if questions?
Like, I
Jay?
Have, what does it feel like to speak internationally? So I've done that last month in TICT.
Congratulations.
In KSA. What does it feel like to speak in front of so many people? What does it feel like to be more aware of my finances? All those hard questions. And then as my journey progressed as an adult person, I realized that having these kinds of goals, if not because of the tick box, but it makes me a whole lot of a better person for me and for other people as well.
For that growth.
Because of that growth. Now, in terms of having kids, it really is it really boils down to what your priorities are, right? And it is expensive, but there's something that you can do about it. There's good news in that. In that argument, like if people don't want to have kids, there are good news that you can have kids if you want to, but there's a better path.
Well, interestingly, Andrew Hallam, whose book is an absolute go-to for so many expats, expat millionaire, he did a study recently surveying over 1,000 people. And his study suggests that parents tend to be more financially responsible and actually accumulate more wealth.
Money.
So how do you interpret these findings? And how can you unpack that?
I love that study by Andrew. Shout out to Andrew for being one of my heroes, by the way. It validates the fact what has happened to me and my wife personally recently, that those who are expecting kids tend to be more responsible in their finances, and they tend to be more into the planning side of things versus those who are just living life, not YOLO, but at least not even carefree, but at least knowing that nobody else is expecting their income but themselves.
Well, I mean, the flip of that is if you are child free or childless, however you frame it in your mind, you probably need to be aware that you are going to be looking after yourself most likely until the end. It's not a case of, you know, you're going to be moving in with your children, which is, you know, can happen in many cultures. So it's quite interesting to think about both sides.
It has to be.
So many people focus on these kind of external factors, like, you know, the economy, governmental policies. But you suggest, when weighing up the decision to have children, look at
internally,
internal factors.
Yes.
So how do you feel like people should assess their personal priorities, finances, emotional stability?
Yeah, so those are the three things that I always look at. Because when I'm doing coaching sessions, most people have those problems. But then they realize eventually that those problems are external, like things that that are happening outside of their control. So I change the conversation into those internal things. Like, first, what is your priority? Why do you really want to have a family? Why do you want to have a child in the first place? Is it because you wanted them? Really ask that deep question within yourself, that I want to have a child because I want to have a child. It's something I really value. I enjoy raising kids. I enjoy having kids. So that has to be clear first. Clarity has to be there first.
And it's got to be for the right reasons.
That's got to be for the right reasons. Not because
that's what you're going to hold on to.
Some people want to have kids because they think their kids are their financial investments, their retirement fund, which is exactly one of the reasons why many Filipinos right now are poor and doesn't.
I've never heard that before. I would think the opposite.
No, that's a common mindset with older Filipinos. I'm not sure with other parts of the world. Like, they think that they're raising kids because they would help them in their retirement years, financially, emotionally, and all the lees.
Interesting. Whereas my dad said to me recently, "We don't want to rely on you in our senior years."
Well, they say that. The older generation say that we don't want to rely on you, but the time that they retire, that's a time that they really have to ask money from you. Like, 65% of Filipinos who retire are dependent in their grown children, and like most of them are living within the same house, in the same. Maybe it's cultural, I'm not sure, but there are other parts of the world who. I've spoken to other nationalities, but they also have this kind of...
That's really interesting. So, there are so many reasons why, you know, people choose to have children.
Yeah.
I mean, as you said, talking about legacy and, you know,
legacy,
that idea of, you know, just having that maternal and paternal instinct. There's also this societal pressure.
Societal pressure,
you know, why haven't you? Why aren't you? Which is something we're going to be exploring throughout the rest of the show. We are going to be speaking to Jill in just a few minutes, but let's hear from Seth Rogen. This is him speaking on Diary of a CEO about his decision to stay child-free.
You referenced earlier you don't have any kids.
I do not. That has helped me succeed as well. Definitely.
Really?
Oh, yeah. There's a whole huge thing I'm not doing.
Yeah, but it would make you happier. You know, someone might say that.
I don't think it would. I've been around, obviously, a lot of children. I'm not ignorant to what it's like to. I've seen everyone I know has kids. I'm 40 again. You know, like, it's not. I know. You know, some of my friends have had kids for decades. You know, some people want kids, some people don't want kids. I think a lot of people have kids before they even think about it. From what I've seen, honestly, you just are told. You go through life, you get married, you have kids. It's what happens. And me and my wife were just, neither of us were like that, you know? And honestly, the older we get, the more happy and reaffirmed we are with our choice to not have kids. Like, it was something we kind of talked about more, and we were like, have we made the right choice? Are we sure? Now, if more than anything, the conversation is like, honestly, thank God we don't have children. We get to do whatever we want. We're in the prime of our lives. We are smarter than we've ever been. We understand ourselves more than we ever have. Me and my wife seem to get a lot more active enjoyment out of not having kids than anyone I know seems to get out of having kids.
Seth Rogen there talking to Stephen Bartlett on Diary of a CEO. So that phrase, child-free by choice rather than childless, I think a really important distinction, is being heard more and more. We are seeing birth rates dropping. We're talking there about some of the financial barriers. But what if you simply don't want to have children? A recent survey by the University of Southampton found that less than half of younger millennials, so 25 to 34, said they definitely or probably intend to have children. It's a lot of people choosing not to. And it's been really, really interesting. I put out a story on my Instagram last night and just said, and I was really surprised because me talking about having kids a lot, I'm a, you know, parent myself. Just how many messages I got from people saying, that's me, child-free, loving it, would love to tell you my perspective. I'm going to be hearing from a number of people throughout the course of the show. And of course, the text lines are open if you want to share your perspective. Joining us now on Teams is Jill, Canadian-born teacher who met her husband here in the UAE. Jill, thank you so much. I loved what you'd messaged me about, which is why I wanted to get you on today. Would you mind kind of unpacking a little bit about your journey and maybe some of the factors that influenced you and your husband to be child-free by choice?
Most definitely. I think I've grown up never wanting to have children. I'm a very independent person. I like my time for myself. I'm not saying I don't love children because I am a teacher. So I left Canada to come to the UAE with the travel bug. When I got here, after a few years of teaching, I met my husband, who is also wanted to be child-free unless he could be guaranteed his son could make the national rugby team in Ireland. So it was an easy decision for us both not to have children. And then just being here, and I think in Dubai, I've met a lot of really good friends who are choosing the same path that we are, where it's a choice to not have children. And it just seems a bit more common here than when I was back home in Canada and everybody was progressing the next step. You get married, you have kids, you get the mortgage, and just kind of follow those life paths.
Jill, have you felt any kind of societal or family expectations or pressures? And did they, you know, impact the way you felt about your decision? How have you navigated any of that? Or has it really been, much like I feel about people who choose not to have children, it's absolutely none of my business and absolutely power to you?
I feel like it's been pretty smooth. Not too many people question it. My parents said since I've been young, I've always stated I don't want children. I don't know how you guys did it. You always have to put your children first. And that's part of being a parent. And I said, I'm a bit selfish with my time, my money, and I like to focus on me. I think the most pressure I get is from my students. They're like, Miss, you don't want to have children? I was like, I have 180 students every single day. I get to send you guys home to your parents. And then I have the evenings for myself. Well, but they're like, but you're so good with kids. I'm like, that's why I became a teacher.
It's interesting. I used to work with a woman called Karen, who actually was Canadian as well. And I was probably late 20s and she was early 40s. And her and her husband had known from, you know, the moment they met, the moment they got together, that they didn't want to have kids. And, you know, much like you're talking there about, you know, had this travel bug. And she said it was very much an other people's problem. And her family stopped asking her when she turned 40. I think a lot of them had assumed that, oh, you know, when you meet the right person, or when, you know, when you see your friends having kids, or when you've held more babies, you'll change your mind and you'll see what you're kind of quote unquote missing out on. She said it was such a relief when people stopped asking. And I feel like people get a bit defensive because it's kind of like, oh, well, you've chosen a different route. So how does that make me feel about my decision to have kids? Have you had any conversations from parents going, you know, don't say this out loud, but I'm maybe a bit envious of that choice that you've made?
Yeah, at times. One of my really good friends, she always wanted to be a mom, always wanted to have children. And with her, she's like, oh, I wish I didn't have kids at time. Or, you know, you guys get to go and do this, but we're having kids. So there has been some conversations about that. But I think one thing for me where I haven't had too many awkward or too many like feeling the pressure conversations is the fact that I've been clear from day one. I've never wanted children, and that either take it or leave it. That's how I am. And that's how my life will be.
So what advice then, Jill, would you give to any other people who are considering a child-free life but are uncertain because of some of those questions, challenges, or even a bit of self-doubt?
I think it's just you need to weigh out what some of your life goals are, what things you value in your life, and thinking, would a child, having a child, make your life complete? Or, you know, once a parent has a child, I still say this to my parents, like, I'm going home to Canada to stay with my parents. You're a parent for life. It's not just 18 and out the door. So if that's something you're happy with and you want to commit and, you know, always put your children first, then maybe the having a child is for you. I don't remember a time growing up where my parents weren't there for my sports matches, for a concert, for any single event. The hours and time that they dedicated to my brother and I just like amazed. And I still thank them every day for it. And I'm like, I'm glad I've chose the path I did, because I'm, again, selfish with my time. And I like to focus on me. I like to focus on my training. I like to focus on my work and my coaching. And no, I've made the right decision.
Jill, thank you so much. And some really amazing messages coming in for you. Teacher Jill Clegg there sharing her story. We're going to be hearing from more people who are child-free by choice. Message here saying, women who choose not to have kids are still viewed as being strange. It's getting better, but still, I refuse to defend my choice. And if someone asks why I choose that, I don't answer. And then ask them why they did. Most can't articulate it. Anonymous message here saying, I spent my 30s undoing childhood damage and I chose not to have children. Message here saying, it wasn't a conscious decision initially, but a friend started to talk about having babies. I just realised I didn't want them. I was having a fabulous time travelling the world in my 20s and 30s, climbing the career ladder, living around the world. Then I realised I wouldn't give my lifestyle up for a baby. My biggest worry as a single woman was meeting a man I really liked who was set on having kids. It was, and it was a hard line in the sand for me. I like my life. I've never felt ashamed to say that. And if someone asks why I choose not to have kids, I ask them, why did they choose to have them? Nikki there. We are talking about being child-free by choice. Some really interesting messages coming in, questions as well. Anonymous one here saying, Seth Rogen and Jill articulated my own thoughts exactly on not having children. And that's interesting because traditional wisdom has always talked about this biological clock that, you know, we all have this innate desire to have kids, and not giving in to this desire comes at the cost of regret. But according to a recent study published in PLOS One, that might not be the case. The study found that 1 in 5 adults surveyed opts not to have children, and they often make this decision in their teens or early 20s and tends to persist into 40s and beyond, countering the widespread notion that adults who are child-free by choice are quote-unquote missing out. We've got some really interesting voice notes that have come in, some messages more. And joining us in studio, we have got Sade Filio. She's a PR manager for Group of Hotels here in Dubai. You've been here since 2010, I think, Sade, is that right? Thank you for joining the conversation. Can I ask you, how long have you been married?
I've been married for 2 years, but I've been with my husband for the last, 10 years.
And he's French, right?
Yeah, he is.
So we were just talking before with Jill, who's saying that she felt quite a lot of pressures in her native Canada, and more pressure than she has done here in the UAE about being on this very expected path of you meet someone and you get engaged and you get married and then you have a baby and then you get the questions going, well, when are you having another baby? Which is, you know, tends to be the case. Tell us, if you wouldn't mind, when and why did you decide not to have kids, and how did that conversation go with your husband? How did you kind of test the waters? Be like, are we on the same page? Yeah, we're on the same page.
Yeah.
Sweet.
I mean, look, it all started with like my own belief as well. Like, I knew from an early age that I really didn't want to have kids. I went to, you know, Catholic school, all girls Catholic school, just to make it even worse. You know, and every friend of mine was kind of like, you know, having this path of like, oh, I want to get married at this age. I want to have a child at this age. And like, it never really hit me at all. And I was like, okay, maybe it's going to hit me, you know, once I get older. Like when I was in high school and university, I entered the workforce and it just didn't click at all. You know, that biological clock that you were talking about.
Did you get the kind of classic comments of going, oh, but when you meet the right person?
Oh, God. I mean, look, I'm Filipino, right? So Asians, I mean, we have a very, very distinct culture that has a classic expectancy of having a family and what a family looks like, and that kind of familial path of like, you need to get engaged and get married and have these many kids. And the question always is, who's going to take care of you when you're old? It's like, well, isn't that why retirement homes exist? yeah, so...
And what was it culturally then with your husband being French? Did you get any kind of, you know, some of the questions from family as well?
Yeah, so my husband being French, they're primarily Catholic as well. So there's a kind of unity in that. But I guess what's wonderful about my family and his family were that they were not the traditional Catholics in the sense that, oh, you need to have a family, you need to have children, and for you to be considered a true family, you need to have kids. And in the modern times, like sometimes, yeah, a cat or a dog would suffice, right? And there was never any question or pressure from either side. And we know we're one of the fortunate ones.
I would say yes, because yeah. I feel like what I found is, you know, once I, you know, met my husband and, you know, decided to have children, the... What you get a lot of people doing is basically judging you on your decisions based on how they feel about their insecurity about their own decisions. Yeah. So if you make the same decision as me, then that means I've made the right decision. You're validating my decision to have children. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And I think that's a really... And it happens all the time in parenting, by the way. People put a comment saying, oh, I'm thinking about buying a buggy. And people go, oh, you must buy this. And like, you're only saying that because you spent $5,000 on that and you want to feel better about your decision.
Yeah.
Or what school? Oh, well, this one is the best one. Like, you don't know if it's the best one.
Yeah.
But, you know, these kind of big life decisions. And I think people do it, even things like leaving Dubai, and go, oh, gosh, that's now shaken my... Have you had any kind of wobbles based on seeing other people's life experiences?
I mean, I saw my friends getting married and you know, having kids and everything, but I mean, maybe once or twice, especially now that I have a niece and nephew as well, it was kind of like, oh my God, like they're cute. But then, you know, when
I can give them back.
Yeah, but that's kind of it, right? Like, when you spend a lot of time with them, like me, like for the last 2 summers spending time with them, it's like, God, if I had my own children, there's no off button. And there's no, I feel like there's no time to pursue my own interests or hobbies. Like, even something as, I don't know, watching the new Bridgerton series, wherein, you know, you just want to have some
time. Can't watch that with kids.
Yeah, you can. No,
I completely agree. And I think it's hard. It is really hard to have kids.
So it's difficult. You
really need to want them. And like Jay was saying earlier, Jay Tolentino's in the studio, you know, having that why and being resolute in that why, that is what's going to get you through those really long nights and those days where you feel like I'm doing a bad job at work and I'm doing a bad job at home and I'm making nobody happy and I'm just, you know, I'm a bad parent. You know, that's what gets you through.
I mean,
so if you're unsure in the first place, I think a lot of people have kids for the wrong reasons is really what I'm saying.
Because I believe that parenthood is a vocation. It's a calling, you know. It's not something that you just decide from the get-go. It needs to come from within and it should never, ever come from societal pressures or familiar pressures because, I mean, you know, dealing with my own childhood, I would say traumas and whatever. But you know when a parent or a couple who's had a kid out of, you know, not by choice, the way they raise their kids are so different. And that particular child is going to be part of society once they're, you know, they turn into an adult.
Absolutely.
And what kind of influence is that child going to bring into the world? So you also need to think about that. How are you going to raise a human being that's going to contribute positively to society?
Big question today, and now I'm thinking about that. In the studio today, we've got Sade Filioj. We've also got Jay Adrian Tolentino. We've had so many messages on this. So let's have a little listen to some of the voice notes coming in. 4001 if you want to join the conversation. This is Courtney.
Hi, I'm Courtney. I'm 44 years old. I've been married to my husband for 21 years. When we were married in our early 20s, I think we both thought children were always going to be part of our future. It wasn't until our 30s that we really sat down and said, do you know what? I don't think that we are going to have kids, and we're totally okay with that. Each couple is going to be on a different path, and we're child-free by choice. That's something that, you know, not everybody comes to the same decision, and I fully respect that. You know, I know couples that have gone through the IVF process and have been unable to have children, and they're in a very different situation than we are. Like, I love kids. I have nieces and nephews. I have traveled with children. There are kids in my life. It's just not for me and for us. I'm quite happy and confident in my choice. And, you know, I have to look at something maybe like during COVID when, you know, parents had to be teachers and full-time caregivers and think, okay, you know, we made the right choice for us. I do think, though, I can have an impact on the next generation, maybe not through having my own children directly, but for example, I write young adult novels, or I, you know, I have a close relationship with nieces and nephews. There are just different ways to be a part of a child's life. I have just chosen to not have them specifically.
Courtney there, she's the one that introduced me to the concept of being a dink, which is a dual income, no kids. And she is a dink wad, which is dual income, no kids, with a dog. Speaking of dogs, this is Yvonne, who has one.
Hi, Helen. My name is Yvonne. I am a 34, almost 35-year-old woman, and I am child-free by choice. I just never felt that I was born to become a mum. I just never had the thoughts or the feelings that I thought, you know, this is what I was destined to be. I'm a great auntie, though. I love the children of my friends. I love my sister's little girl and my other sister. She's pregnant now and actually about to pop soon. So I'm really excited about that. But yeah, I just never felt that that was for me, that that was my lifestyle. I mean, the responsibility financially, also the world that we live in. I mean, it sort of scares me as well a little bit. You know, just the thought of having to bring up kids in this world. And yeah, and also how much it changes your life. And, you know, I've heard it, all of the feedback, you know, from everybody that loves me. And they said, oh, well, you know, if you find the right partner or when you're older, you know, but it never happened, even, you know, with who I thought was the right partner. And I was like, no, it's just not for me. You know, like I said, I'm okay with kids, but not all kids, you know, especially from strangers. And I'm not the kind of person that would be like, oh yeah, I'll hold your baby, you know. So yeah, and obviously I've heard the feedback as well, like, you know, if it's your own child it will be different. But yeah, I don't think so, and I'm also not really you know, I don't want to take the risk. I'm great with pets, though, which surprises a lot of people, because I'm really an animal lover and I love taking care of animals and have quite a few pets myself. And so a lot of people see me as a very emotionally attached person and taking care of them, and they see me, you know, as a potentially a good mom, I guess. But it's just not what I want, for so many reasons, and I just never felt it. I've never had my ovaries going like, you know, it's time to make babies. I've never had that. And yeah, it is what it is. But I'm very happy with my pets, and I'm very happy with that choice of life of not having children.
Yvonne sharing her insights there. What I love is just the absolute kind of self-awareness and self-knowledge of that this is the decision. Because as I said earlier, you know, an awful lot of judgment from whether it's peers and parents. And I genuinely have friends who are dinks and dingwads. And that I just feel like power to you. Your decision makes absolutely no bearing on my life at all. So why the judgment? Continuing our discussions now around being child-free by choice. Joining us in studio, financial educator Kuya Jay, and we've also been hearing from some first-person perspectives, both on the voice notes and also from Shardé Filio, who is in studio too. Message here saying, we're planning to have kids because we have this feeling we need a goal to work towards when we get old. It's a big decision financially and lifestyle-wise, and the world doesn't see a big drop in population as not having kids is common thinking now. Well, it certainly is. We are seeing big declines, certainly out of the UK. China just recently reporting a decline for the second year straight. That conversation is very, very complicated, and perhaps one for another day. But let's go to the text line. This is from Selene, who has been in touch talking about her decision to be child-free by choice.
You know, I always thought I was going to have kids. If you had spoken to me in my 20s, I would have said something like, yeah, in 10 years, and I kept saying that. until I was 30 on a solo trip around Vietnam. And I realized I can't keep saying in 10 years. And I really took the time to reflect on whether or not I did want to have kids and how much was my own voice versus family and society pressures. Taking the time made me realize that having children wasn't for me. There were a number of reasons for that. One was bringing a child into this world with all the wars and especially climate change and how quickly the environment is changing around us. I just didn't feel like I could do that to a child. Second thing was feeling inadequate. I struggled to even look after myself, how I was supposed to then look after a little one. The third one was around the need to change our lifestyle. With my husband, we love traveling and living abroad, and that sense of freedom is really, really important to me and really ingrained within me. So I just couldn't imagine changing that in any way. The fourth one was I have always been worried since I was a little kid about what I might pass on. I experienced a lot of bullying growing up. I'm neurodivergent and I also live with a diagnosed long-term mental health condition. And so that was always a fear in the back of my mind. And then to top that up, the fifth reason is I've always been absolutely terrified and really grossed out about the idea of being pregnant and all the changes to my body. So, yeah, just wasn't for me. After realizing all this, I felt a wave of fear and guilt towards my family and towards society, in the sense of I felt like I was failing at what I was meant to be doing. I also had a conversation with my now husband. We weren't married at the time, because this could be a real deal breaker. Obviously, you can't have half a child. So we were really lucky to be on the same page. And I think that's why it's so important to have these conversations, to talk about these things and to hear the voices of women, particularly women who choose not to have children, because it's so rare. It's also the reason why I speak openly about mental health, about neurodiversity, because I think the more we talk about these things, the more we feel connected to each other, the more we realize that, it's not just me. Mm-hmm. I'm not alone. And I think that's the most important thing that we can do for each other.
Absolutely agree. So Len then talking about her decision, and I love the fact that we're able to give so many different voices a platform, because that representation is absolutely crucial. Now, this is anonymous one sharing her thoughts on being child-free by choice.
Hi, Helen. Love that you're covering this subject. I'm 43 and child-free by choice and always have been. When I was a little girl, I never had dollies. I never had prams. I just never had that kind of instinct. I've always known I didn't want children. The only time that changed slightly was my mum died very suddenly of a heart attack. And then I had this weird maternal instinct. My brother had the first grandchild of the family, and I saw how it affected him being a parent. And I thought, am I missing out on something here? But then I realized it's really not what I wanted at all. I have so many nieces and nephews, be it through my own family or through close friends. Motherhood, or should I say parenthood, but motherhood is the toughest job in the world. And it's just not one I have ever been interested in. It is such hard work. I see it through my friends and my family, and it's just not one I'm interested in. Yes, those small glimmers of when they give you cuddles, or even now with my nieces and nephews, and I walk in, and it's lovely, or they've drawn me a picture, it's amazing. But to me, those small glimmers don't outweigh the amount of sacrifice you have to give up, and that's just not something I've ever been interested in doing. And again, I've actually been called selfish, both in this region and back in the UK where I'm from, which I find bizarre, but decision I've made, and I'm very happy with it.
Good for you. Thank you again to everyone who joined the conversation, to Sade and QJ in the studio. And as ever, it really is important to me that we are hearing from lots of different perspectives and voices from around the UAE. So there's a topic that you'd like to cover. If there's a story or an insight that you would like to share, you know the numbers, and I'd love to hear from you. Very distinguished guest with us in the studio today, Dr. Helmut Schüssler, chairman of TVM Capital Healthcare, extensive background in healthcare investment and management, really strong focus on innovation, healthcare solutions. So today we're talking about preventative genomics, which kind of identifying the genetic health risks in healthy adults and how addressing these risks can prevent and delay the onset of illness. We're talking about moving from a sick care model to a proactive healthcare model. A recent study from Human Longevity Inc. emphasized the value of this approach, talking about so many of us have actionable diseases without realizing it, and how doing sequencing can help us proactively predict risk, working with patients, manage those risks. Dr. Helmuth, how are you, sir?
Very good. Thank you for the invitation. I'm really pleased to be here.
I wanted to continue a little bit of our previous conversation, which is about being child-free by choice. We had a number of people talking about, you know, the drop in population, which we are seeing in, well, actually a colleague talking about Australia. It's been, you know, talking about the UK, China reporting a decline for the second year in a row earlier this year. With your, you know, economist hat on, can we explore a little bit about before we move on to our kind of health topic, can we talk about global population and what impact that might have, people choosing to not have children and not having those societal pressures that it might have been subjected to previously?
Yeah, of course. So what we're seeing, and I think what's supported by statistics globally, is that as societies mature and become more affluent, there is a natural tendency to have fewer kids. And I think that from a sociological point of view, it's very understandable, because in very poor societies, children are actually a part of what we're talking about, which is health insurance and life insurance, because there is no other systems. Mm-hmm. In poor societies, children were your wealth, because they could take care of you when you were getting old. And this was a hugely important task. And as societies mature, become more affluent, insurance schemes, sickness funds, life insurance is becoming more prevalent, that pressure goes away. So people also are becoming more educated. They go and to high school and then to university, and they have jobs later in life. They decide to also have families later in life. And all of that kind of culminates ultimately in sort of our reproduction rates dropping.
What do you think that was going to impact in terms of workforce, or, you know, workforce moving around the world? What are you hearing?
I think we will have huge impact from that in general. And one of the topics to talk about is migration, mm-hmm. obviously, and it's something that we are already seeing, exacerbated by climate change. I think there's a lot of things that are actually coming together, mm-hmm. And we will see a lot of people becoming expats. At the moment, there's either refugees or expats who are affluent, but just decide to go somewhere else and work there for tax reasons.
It's a proactive choice.
For opportunity reasons, it's a proactive choice. But I think going forward, there will be two things. One is, from some parts of the world, probably driven by climate, people will want to leave and go somewhere where they have more opportunity in life. And in the more affluent Western societies, or increasingly also Eastern societies, they will need new people. So immigration will become actually a very positive thing. Now, how we are going to deal with all of this in this world, I don't know yet, but it's a challenge.
We have got Dr. Helmuth Schüssler speaking to us, chairman of TVM Capital Healthcare. Before we get into this idea of longevity and our understanding of it, Doctor, would you mind explaining a little bit about the work that you do at TVM? What is the mission of that company?
The mission is to invest in healthcare companies, and what we do mostly is we create companies or invest in companies, grow companies that provide healthcare infrastructure. So it would be something like a rehab center or a long-term care or post-acute care center. We invested in IVF, in vitro fertilization. We're very interested in the topic of women's health in general. We look at topics like oncologies or cancer clinics, cardiology. Actually, we focus on single specialty clinics, not necessarily hospitals, because there is a lot of hospitals in our region here and in many countries. But what is missing is the ecosystem of hospitals, smaller clinics, which are much more comfortable to be for the patient. It often also cheaper for the insurance companies, for the payers. So it's a win-win, and that's what we focus on.
Interesting. So in terms of, I don't want to say trends, but patterns and where the opportunities lie, it sounds like you've kind of got your finger on the pulse. Can we talk a little bit about how you feel that conversation and the general population's understanding of quote-unquote longevity has changed in recent years? I feel like it's become such a buzzword and it means different things to different people. What does it mean to you?
Yeah, longevity obviously is a very big topic and everybody looks at it in a different way and from a different angle, let me say, or vantage point. We have witnessed in the last 100 years that people grow much older than they used to. Let's go hundreds of years back when people's life expectancy was on average maybe 40 years or 42, 38. Nowadays,
I'm just about to turn 42.
Well, congratulations, right?
Thanks,
I'm much older than you. And the way I look at my birthday today is I'm happy.
I'm pretty happy.
People get depressed when they go above 60, but I'm happy.
What's the alternative?
No, like you either make it there or you don't, right? So the point is today, in the last 100 years or so, we've doubled our life expectancy and now everybody is getting to 80, 85. And we know that women have a little bit of a higher life expectancy than men.
Why is that?
Well,
just sheer grit and determination.
I guess women are very tough.
Mm, we are. We're tough old bit. But it's interesting you mentioned women's health before because, you know, historically, you say hundreds of years ago, women get to 40, but maybe it was 50, maybe it was, 55, 60. And now we've got women, as you say, living to 80, 90 plus. The conversation on the menopause has changed so much in recent years because of that, because you maybe go through the menopause and then you die, or maybe you wouldn't be old enough to reach that hormonal change. Whereas now you've obviously got women who hit the menopause and then they could have 20, 30, 40,
years,
50 years beyond that point. And it's still, I think, really underserviced. And
that's exactly why nowadays women's health is becoming such a big topic because everybody realizes that even our research and clinical development for drugs, for pharma products, for devices is mostly performed on men historically. So it wasn't a criteria in the past to make sure that in a clinical trial of 1,000 people, there is 500 men and 500 women.
Which is insane when you think about physiological differences.
It completely is. But people notice today that criterion was never really looked at. Mm-hmm. And now we realize, because of what you said before, precision medicine being a topic, when you look at the data, when you have the data, and we increasingly have the data, you suddenly realize that certain symptoms for diseases are different between men and women. So when a man says, "Oh, I have pain here," a woman would probably say, "Oh, no, I don't feel anything, but I have pain down here." And
but they both could be having a heart attack.
they could both mean the same thing. Yeah. And nobody ever paid attention to this. And I think that really has to change. And it will change. I'm absolutely convinced of that.
So we're living longer, but are we living healthier? Because I think that's been a conversation as well, that this idea of, I want to live forever. It's like, I don't want to live forever. I want to live well for as long as possible.
Yeah.
We're seeing some absolutely bonkers things happening internationally in terms of people who, I don't want to say have too much money, but I don't feel like anyone should be a billionaire, having, blood infusions and, hanging upside down and all of, what are the kind of the weirdest things that you're seeing people trying or researching in a quest to live longer, look younger?
Yeah, well, if people can afford it.
keeps the wheels turning.
I'm happy to read the reports of this because these are statistics of one, right? So what in the medical profession is called anecdotal evidence. Mm-hmm. So if there is enough people who try things because they can afford it to go somewhere to pay a lot of money for certain treatments, then we will learn something from it. It is not technically a clinical trial, of course, because you need statistical significance of that. For that, you need regulatory approval for that. But these trials of one can be very eye-opening in terms of what's happening, what's actually helping, where science is going.
What's caught your eye recently in those anecdotal experiences? What we thought, that could be worth pursuing, that could be worth investing in.
I honestly have to say, and I don't want to mention any particular people or whatever they do, but I can tell you that I think there's two or three different approaches to the question of how long do we live, and if we want to live longer, what do we have to do? And you mentioned in the beginning a company that I happen to know quite well by the name of Human Longevity Inc. And a study they published a couple of years back, I think it was pre-COVID, about their clinical evidence. And what they were saying is that they started being a longevity clinic back in 2017 or so, or 18 or so. And what they found from looking at thousands of patients is that about 14% of the people who walk in the door saying they are totally healthy have clinically relevant issues that would suggest that they go to a hospital immediately.
Immediately. Not just keep an eye on this.
Not just having a sore throat. No, I mean wow. Actionable now. And that is actually a pretty big number. That's 1.5 in 10, mm-hmm. right? So how many people do you know who say, well, I'm okay, you know, I'm healthy, I'm okay. Well, 1 in 10 of those or 2 in 10 of those will be wrong at the time they say it. And that's frightening. But it also points to a way to make that go away.
I noticed, I looked down to your hand earlier, sir, and said, is that an aura ring? And I understand that you've been one of the first people to have tried it, and 5 years on, still wearing it. Tell us a little bit about the Aura Ring. And I mean, I think Prince Harry made it famous.
Well, it's actually a very useful device. And it, you know, it is coming actually from sleep science and sleep therapy. So the people who founded Aura are coming from that side, not from the exercise or athletic side. Yeah. It's more sleep. And as we analyze the data that we've been talking about, we understand also that sleep is one of the most critical components in people's healthy aging and longevity. Mm. So I think it's relevant. It's highly relevant. And what this thing tells me here on a daily basis on the app is how good my sleep was, how much deep sleep, how much REM sleep, how much light sleep, when I fell asleep, when I woke up during the night and all of that. It's actually really interesting data.
Here's the thing. I wore a Fitbit for a while, which hasn't got the same science in terms of the sleep priority. But I found it really dictated my mood. I'd wake up and it said, you've had, you know, 5 hours of rubbish sleep. Even if I felt okay, I would be like, oh, I'm going to be really low energy today, rather than listening to my body. I think data anxiety is real. Obviously, you have a different hat on as someone who works in
healthcare. I have a different view of this, because I think that, first, the ring has never told me anything that I didn't know anyway, right?
Just affirming.
Exactly as you say. You listen to your body, you know if you had a good night or not. But when you see the data, when you see that a bottle of white wine would increase your average heart rate during the night by a good 15 beats a minute. Wow. So if your average heart rate is, let's say, 55 or 60, you'd be looking at 70, 75 as your heart rate. And heart rate variability is down, mm-hmm. but it should be high. Mm-hmm. So this is not,
I guess,
the place to talk about all these things, but you can read up on them. It gives you these indicators, and it tells you very clearly, because you know what you did in the evening when you ate late, you had a lot of alcohol, and then you look at those data and the correlation is obvious.
The body keeps the score.
So you do what is right for you, right? Mm-hmm.
And interesting. Now, earlier this week, we were broadcasting from the Syra Hotel at Trade Center, which is the world's first hotel that is about fitness and recovery. So, you know, in the rooms, you know, there's workout equipment, it's blueberries in the mini bar. And then, you know, in terms of the gym and the fitness and the treatments, you know, infrared and, cold plunge and lots around mindfulness and relaxation. They talked about these five pillars, which I'm going to try and remember. Sleep, we've just talked about there. Nutrition, fitness, mindfulness, and recovery. And I wondered, out of those, or perhaps if there's any other pillar that you think for us to live a long, happy, healthy life, what should we be focusing on?
Yeah, those are definitely five extremely important ones. And I do think that exercise, Sleep are probably key, but what I believe and what actually has been proven again in studies across the world is the most important is community. You do remember the book on, or at least the movies on blue zones, right?
Yeah, it's on Netflix right now.
Yeah, exactly. And when you look at the blue zone movie, you realize when you look at these communities where people get very old, they're actually communities. People are talking to each other. People do stuff together. They know each other and they have known each other for ages. They grow all together. Yeah. And I think that is a very important thing. And because we talked about migration and we talked about where do we live, et cetera, in the future, I think if you're an expat and you go around a lot, that will be a challenge because you have to figure out early in life where you want to grow older, where you want to have the community that you belong to. Mm-hmm. I think that's a very important part of that whole healthy aging story.
Put the roots down. So this is like an ancient thing, but there's more modern things as well. And I wanted to ask you if you wouldn't mind to explain the concept of preventative genomics and how it differs from the traditional healthcare approaches, because we're talking about creating a proactive healthcare model rather than the kind of reactive sick care model as we were talking about earlier, going to the doctors when you're unwell. Can you explain it in a way that me as a non-doctor and not could understand?
Well, very simply put, in the past you were healthy as long as you weren't in pain, right? And you weren't dizzy and et cetera, and you didn't feel wrong. And when you did, you went to your GP, your family doctor, and you said, "Doctor, I have pain here.
Yeah. I have a sore throat.
What is it, and how can I deal with it?" Yeah. Okay. Then in the best of all cases, the doctor understands what you have and gives you something or gives you advice what you should do, and you walk out. In a less good case, the doctor will say, "Okay, I will give you this and take it twice a day, and if it doesn't work, come back." I used to call this diagnostics by therapy. Because if you don't know, okay, you take something and if it doesn't work, come back, I give you something else. Yeah. Now, that's all good. But if you talk about prevention, I think that prevention is mainly something we have to do ourselves. And I'm very particular about that. I think that we are entering a time in society where we take more responsibility for our own health. We have to take more responsibility for our own health, even if we don't want to, because other players in the industry will force us to. For example, the payers, the people who pay when you have a cancer surgery or when you have an accident after drinking too much alcohol. So taking responsibility for our own life based on the data that are available today and the information that is available is probably going to be a defining element of the society of the future.
Some really interesting messages coming in here. One asking, is preventative genomic sequencing covered by insurance? That would be nice.
Generally not.
Yeah. What does that look like in practice if someone wants to be that proactive?
You go and you get it done. It's actually not particularly expensive
these
days.
Where do I go?
Where do you go? Oh, my God. There is, in the meanwhile, a rather large number of clinics that will provide that service, whether they are, you know, sort of flying under the longevity banner or the wellness banner. All of them will provide that service. You can go to hospitals as well, because the technology itself is completely abundant. It has been, as people sometimes say, democratized. Mm-hmm. There is now systems that will cost you for a whole genome sequencing $200, $300, the most modern technology, because it's so fast and it's become very cheap.
A message is saying, what's your guest view on genetics as a predictor of our health behaviors? For example, I've recently seen research that suggests that being an early bird or a night owl is actually defined by genetics rather than simply a lifestyle choice. So your sleep chronotype, which was essential back in the cave person days where you had some people keeping guard through the dark hours and then you had someone up during the day to keep the saber-toothed tigers away. What do we know about that?
Well, I personally believe that you should probably find out what you are and then try to behave accordingly.
So don't fight it.
Don't fight it. Don't fight it if you can. Not everybody has a choice,
no,
right?
No, if you're working shifts and things.
Exactly. But if you can listen to your body will tell you that. But when we talk to about this societal change, because that's, from my point of view, is a very important topic. A friend of ours, an owner of a longevity clinic in Singapore, actually, she said at a recent TVM conference something which I remember, and that is, we have to become the CEOs of our own health. And I haven't found a better way of saying it. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of clinics, there is a lot of technologies and that can help you stay healthy by providing information, by providing data. But since nobody's forcing you...
No one's knocking on your door, are they?
Nobody's telling you, you have to do this, you have to do that, mm-hmm. at least not at this point in time. So you have to either want this or be disciplined enough to follow your own prescriptions and your own objectives, or you don't. It's your choice.
A message here saying, do you have any insight on how eye health affects longevity? I was diagnosed with Stargardt's disease, which is a retinal disease, obviously hoping for treatment soon. But with eye health, is that something that you're looking at TVM? And
no, not at this point in time. I couldn't advise on that, actually.
Watch this space, potentially. Yeah. We were talking off air about things that you do and indeed don't do. We're talking about eating in moderation. What about exercise, especially as we get older? How do we need to adjust what we do or indeed avoid for living well for longer?
All right. Well, there is, again, a new set of studies have been done in the last 10, 20 years. And what emerges very clearly is that as we age, we have to make sure that we don't lose muscle mass. Muscle mass is a predictor of longevity. And since men and women start losing muscle basically at 25 or something, yeah. or 30, I think focusing on strength training and weight training is probably, especially as you enter your 50s and 60s, absolutely critical. Not just for well-being and feeling good and strong,
no,
but
it's
also
functionality. It's being able to
pure help. Functionality yeah. and
don't fall over. Be able to open that door.
And that's one of the points. If you're 85 and you've lost more than half of your muscle, you're very fragile.
Yeah, this is why so many people sadly pass away after having a hip replacement. It's use it or lose it. We've run out of time. Dr. Helmut Schüssler, thank you so much for coming in. It's been really, really interesting.
Great pleasure.
Really, really enjoyed your insights there. And I might have to invest in an Oura ring. She says wearing an analog watch and that's about it. Okay, I'm going to be the CEO of my own health. You heard it here first. Really important topic and a quite emotional one, to be honest. How to choose the right nursery for your child. There are so many different teaching methods, Montessori, child-led, play-based. It can be really overwhelming for parents to decide which approach is best. Joining us to help navigate this, we've got Area Director of Odyssey Nurseries Dubai, Diana Zaidan, is with us as well, who's going to be helping us kind of navigate these options, offering some insights and tips. And we've got mum of two, Houri Maljian, is with us today. She's an independent public relations consultant in early learning and child development. And she's got children. First one went to Odyssey Nursery and Toddlers Now at Redwood Montessori. So experienced a few different methods of education there, Houri. We're going to be coming to you in a few minutes. But first of all, I want to establish, are we talking about this at the right time, Diana? When do people tend to look for a nursery? And is it too late to be looking now for September?
Actually, there's no specific time to search for a nursery. So it depends on the family needs, on the child's needs as well. Some of the parents also ask us, when should we register? What age? What is the age appropriate
the
for a child?
Big question. Do you have any answers to that?
Of course not. Mm-hmm. So we do accept children starting the age of 4 months up to the age of 5 years old, 6 years old. So we have even the FS1, the FS2. It depends on the need of every family.
Totally.
And the readiness of the child. Mm-hmm. So yes, we do support children in settling in. We support even the families. Specifically, we do separation. We work on the separation anxiety, not only for the with the children, we work it specifically.
For the parents.
For mommy and daddy, of course.
That was me crying in the car outside the nursery. Hori, can I ask you, we're going to talk a little bit more about how to narrow things down. But when you started looking at nurseries for your boys, what were your big kind of concerns? What were the questions you were asking yourself in order to work out where was going to be right for you?
Yeah. Actually, Helen, a lot of people think that we choose a nursery according to convenience, like location. But you'd be surprised at the amount of parents in Dubai who are willing to drive like really long distances for a really top-notch nursery. Mm-hmm. So actually, my first went to Odyssey, which is Reggio Emilia teaching approach. And my second now is at Redwood Montessori. So very different teaching methods.
Well, are they? Tell me, Diana, can you break down some of the most commonly used teaching methods? You know, Montessori talks about their childbed-based, you know, so many different things.
Yes.
And it can get a bit overwhelming, especially if it's your first and you're like, ugh.
So it's a good question, and this is a question that most of the parents ask while doing the nursery shopping. We say they go around, they ask for these approaches. What is the difference between Montessori and Reggio Emilia? I just want to say that we all work on children's development on all areas. We cover all areas. Child is developing physically, socially, emotionally, cognitively. So we cannot work on them differently. Yes, I can go through the details of how Montessori works with children, how as Reggio Emilia approach as well. But in general, we work on developing the child holistically. It's so important for parents to understand how to choose the nursery to make sure that the environment is reflecting everything the children need, to make sure that the staff are qualified enough to support children in their development.
So how do you know, if it is your first, for example, which nursery or which nursery approach is going to be good for you? Because, you know, not to be too indelicate about it, it's a big spend. And you don't want to be, you know, a few weeks or months into a term and go, this actually isn't right for us at all.
It's true. So also we're getting a lot of parents who are like Hori, who came to us saying that my child is a bit shy. Maybe this approach works best for him. The other one maybe will not let him flourish more. Here I can say that any approach can work on children's needs. Like Reggio Emilia approach, if you have a very bubbly child, sociable, he loves to interact with others, he works on projects that needs the support from their peers, mm-hmm. Being collaborative, more into creative thinking, critical thinking, problem-solving skills. So this is what Reggio Emilia is about, working a lot with their social skills, how to communicate together, how to understand each other's needs, how to work on soft skills like we work on their, as I mentioned, the communication, empathy, care, sharing, all of these skills, they develop it with the Reggio approach. Not to mention that, yes, Montessori as well, they work all of these differently.
And how they've responded to different methods, Hori.
Yeah, actually, it's very funny because my firstborn who went to the Reggio Emilia is a very Montessori child at home, Helen. So he has so much self-discipline. He has so much self-discipline. He loves like individual projects. He'll sit there for hours. So funny enough, I put him in a Reggio nursery and I saw him flourish. Like, he used to be so shy in a groups in the Reggio nursery. He's so comfortable with the kids. He's so creative. He'll go out into nature because actually Reggio classrooms, they look like ateliers. So they look like workshops. That's how they're meant to look like workshops. Mm-hmm. So when you go in, I personally don't want to leave, to be honest. Like, they have, you know, they have like a chandelier made of like dry lemons and stuff. They have loose parts. Like, they don't use Play-Doh. They use clay. Because clay is also for sensory kids. So Serge was a sensory kid. So they use clay because it feels cold to the touch. It has that aromatic, earthy smell. So these are elements that Reggio has. Funny enough, my second is not a Montessori child. This guy, he's bubbly, he sings, he loves being center of attention. I put him in a Montessori nursery. This guy, the first day, I'm watching him from the door. He picks up his little cereal bowl. He like goes and he puts it on the sink. I was like, okay, this is going to work at home.
Can I get my 9-year-old into Montessori approach? We've got some really interesting messages coming in and some questions as well for you guys. Hori and Diana in the studio today as we talk about choosing nurseries. One here saying, two working parents have to think about logistics, pick up, drop off times, close to work, no traffic. Expense and curriculum are secondary considerations. You are speaking to the right woman here because we chose a nursery that was, wait for it, 2 streets away that our nanny could walk to and pick the kids up from. But we were very fortunate in that was a really great nursery, if I should say that. And a message from Jennifer saying, our first questions were regarding the exit handle door height and for pools on the premises. Safety at a young age can't be undervalued. Our next question was if the kids come home clean or dirty. Dirty clothes from creative play was a sign of child-led and play-based learning. We listened to the audio levels, noticed not noise, but joyful sounds. Our wonderful nursery setup for us as parents and our young sons are fans of education and school. Nicole saying operating hours of a nursery was important to us. Absolutely. And no name on this one, but question for you, Diana, saying how do you identify in a nursery if a child has learning or additional needs? Interesting question, because some of these kids can be teeny tiny. Must come down to the staff that you choose and work with, right?
Oh, la, it's a really nice question. And so also we work closely with parents when it comes to specific need for the children. We have process in place where we have early detection. Our staff, as you mentioned, should be well trained on how to detect such delays in the children's development. Once we detect any specific like behavioral or developmental delay, we immediately intervene. We ask we have a tie up with many centers that they provide us with like psychologists, speech therapists, occupational therapists, ABA trainers. So we ask them to come and to assess. To do the screening, the first screening, then we share our findings with the parents. Mm-hmm. Some of the parents will take it in a very negative way. Sometimes they are so supportive. And here I can also ask and urge all the parents to really support in every single thing that the nursery is sharing with them. It's not about really highlighting the developmental delay for the child. It's highlighting the fact that we are there for them. We are here to support them.
And working together.
Yes. We are here to support the family, the child, in adapting to any environment, no matter what their development are.
A really interesting point that's just come in and saying the difficulty in having a children is about longevity at nursery if you don't own your residence. So if you're moving a lot because of increasing rents and then growing nursery costs mean multiple changes through that journey. So that's a good point because I think it comes into settling in. So what do you tend to have in place when to help a child, and as we mentioned before, a parent, settle into a new environment? A lot of it's going to depend on age, of course, but in your experience, what can really help?
Oof, our settling in process is really, we work really closely with the families, with specifically with mommy and daddy. We ask them during the first few days that the children are settling in to get us something from home, and specifically like a photo for the mom and the child. The mom can, for example, give kisses.
Or dad, of course. Sorry, just
speaking out for them. So any photo the child feels attached to their home environment, give kisses to this photo, keep it in their pocket. Whenever they are really sad or they want to express their emotions, we just take the photo out. We ask them to take these kisses and to keep it for in their pocket again. So we do not say to the child, mommy will come back, stop crying. It's not okay. For us, this child should express himself, should cry, should ask for mommy. And we're here to support this, to tell him, yes, we hear you. We understand that you're asking for mommy. Here's the clothes. Sometimes mommies can share with us
a
shirt
that
smells.
That drop off can be horrendous. It can.
So brutal, yeah.
And we know rationally as mums and dads, we know that child is most likely going to be fine in 5 minutes. But I remember having a couple of really rocky drop-offs and I would just think, I'm going to work. Have I chosen work over my child's happiness? You know, I'm crying in the car. And then sure enough, get a photo from nursery 15
he's
minutes
happy.
Later. Absolutely fine.
Yeah, he's happy. The moment that we say that the separation should happen that fast, because the more parents are at the nursery in front of the children, the child will be clinging on them. They will not let them go until they are away from their...
Short and sweet. But a lot of it was actually having the confidence that I'd chosen the right nursery. Is this something you find, Tori, that you're like, okay, I've made a really good choice, so I know my kids are safe and they're going to have an amazing day?
Actually, funny enough, Helen, for me, one of the decision factors was the management of the nursery. Diana was one of them, coincidentally. But I always say that feeling and that relationship that I have with the manager, because the manager oversees everything. The director oversees everything, right? So if they're doing a good job, staff are doing a good job, everyone's happy, then if they're happy, children are happy. Absolutely. So for me, that was a huge factor. And the communication every day, because some nurseries, they will not let you have this, like, I want to know, like right now, I want to know, how is my child doing? Has he settled? At Odyssey, it was, you know, right away message, listen, he's doing okay, here's his picture. And right away, I was relieved and I can go on. Yeah.
Communication is key. Really.
This comes to a question we've had from Callum saying, we're looking to start nursery in January. Our son is going to be 18 months old. Starting with three mornings a week, what do you suggest re-days of the week? Should there be consecutive? Should he have a break, etc.? That's a really interesting question. What do you tend to advise?
Of course. First, just to answer the January registration, usually by January, the nurseries are full. So parents should decide earlier than that to register. They'll be so lucky if to find places in January, the term two. But if in case they found a place, 3 days a week, 2 days a week, 5 days a week for us, depending on the age as well. But it's a matter of how we settle in the child. So usually children will adapt easily when there's consistency. And if they choose for 2 days or 3 days a week, we always ask the parents the first 2 weeks to be to use the 5 days a week until the child will adapt. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can reduce the hours. It's not like a full day for the 5 days, just few hours every day.
Exposure,
for the child.
Get familiar.
To get familiar to the Makes environment, sense. To the key person that they will get to used to at the nursery, the place, the environment. So it's key to start the first 2 weeks full, and then when the child will adapt, then we can choose whatever these days are available, depending on the ratio of the day, because sometimes we have, when the ratio is met...
It's like doing a 3D jigsaw puzzle with teaching with assistants and kids. And last question, because we're running out of time. Louisa is saying, how do you decide if a child should do FS1 at nursery or at school? You talked before about nursery readiness. Mm. What about school readiness?
Some of the children, yes, they are. We say they are ready for big school. And parents decide, yes, at the age of 3 years old, I want to take him to a big school. Trust me, we have a lot of parents coming back the first week of September from school saying, no, I saw this environment. We thought that maybe the child is ready, but the environment is too big, too huge for the children now to be to enter such an environment. So the nursery, the difference between a nursery and a school, where the nursery we have flexible hours, so we open 8 to 6.
I was going to say longer days.
Yes, exactly. Longer days, and they feel home because it's a small setting. We always say it's a home away from home. So they eat, they sleep, they interact. It's really a second home for them. It's not only the extended hours at the nursery, it's the care and the focus that we give for every child. So, of course, FS1 in big school, sometimes you can have up to 6-7 classes of FS1, where at the nursery we have one class or two classes, a small group, 12-15 children. So, of course, the focus is different. The interaction is different. The environment is different.
But it's so individual.
That's the difference. Yes, they can be ready, but it's a little bit harsh when we say early years covered 6 years
I
old.
I know. I
mean, keep them in a small setting.
On the flip side, though, the chance of getting a spot for FS2 in some schools is downright impossible. So many variables there, Louisa. So thank you for raising that. Guys, we have run out of time. Hurry and Diana in the studio today. Diana Zaidan is the Area Director of Odyssey Nurseries Dubai. If you want those details, you can just send me the word child. We'll keep it super simple. Really appreciate your time, guys. And we are going to continue this discussion, especially around transition changes. Gigi is joining us next, certified kids life coach. So we're going to be talking about changes and what we can do to support our children. It is a time of change right now, whether it is maybe moving schools, leaving the country, maybe there's been some family changes going on, moving house. How our kids cope with it is such a tricky one, because so much of what they take is how we respond to change and transition. So I wanted to bring in certified kids life coach, Gigi Alcad, to kind of hold our hand through this, because Gigi, you speak to children in a way that I really, really admire. And I feel like they really open up to you, whether it's through a camp that you're running over the summer or some of the activations and workshops you've done in the past. And of course, the coaching that you do with families and kids as well. So can you explain why transitions, you know, such as moving to a new school, you know, moving, getting a new class teacher can be really challenging for children? What's going on in their little brains?
Yes. First of all, thank you for having me, Helen.
Pleasure.
I mean, change is not easy, even on us as adults, right? So I think having to hold kids' hands a bit throughout any sort of change, any sort of transition is important, just so it prepares them. Mm-hmm. I think for kids, they definitely like to be prepared. They like to know what to expect. They like to know what's coming. So having some sort of an open communication to kids about what's going on, like, what's happening? Why is it happening? Obviously, in a very honest and age-appropriate manner.
Yes. What I worry about sometimes is we often are quite quick to go, oh, kids are so resilient. Oh, kids, well, you know, oh, we can, you know, move countries three times a year and our kids are resilient and they'll bounce right back. And sometimes I've seen friends do this and I'm like, no, you're maybe telling yourself that to make yourself feel better about some decisions that might really affect your child. Yeah. That word resilient, I think it's often kind of misused and misunderstood. And we think about being about cold, you know, and it's not. What does resilience mean to you, and what role does it play in this conversation about change and transition?
Resilience is basically, I don't want to use the word get back up.
I know what you mean.
Because it's not always, doesn't always make sense to fall and get up again like nothing happened. But it's basically to go through a challenge, go through an obstacle, and have the necessary skills to have the confidence, have the resilience to face it.
I think about feeling safe as well, ask for help if you need help.
Right.
That's just something that adults need to work on as well.
Having the confidence to admit that, you know what, I do need help.
Yeah.
I having, you know, the mindset that I want to work on this problem. Mm-hmm. I want to try and find solutions for it.
Well, so what strategies can parents use then to make their children feel more safe, more comfortable, more confident when facing a significant change, like starting a new school or moving to a new country? Yeah.
So I mentioned communication openly, right? So tell them what's going on. Why is it happening? Validate their feelings. Let them know it's normal for you to feel scared, anxious, or excited about a new change. Give them more information. Any photos? Can you visit a campus? Can you visit the classroom? Can you maybe have some play dates? Can you meet the teacher? Involve them in the process, either picking out, you know, their stationery stuff, their new lunchbox, their bag. If you're moving to a new country, the wall paint for their room, like, involve them in the process more. Maintain also some sort of like routine, some sort of familiar activities for them, so they can feel some sort of stability that's there. Try to focus on the positives, like, regardless of what's going on. And yes, always validate feelings, but also try to let them see what opportunities are coming from them, mm-hmm. what things they can learn from, and what exciting things they can look forward to. Also, for younger kids, definitely use pretend play storytelling, role playing, and explaining that to them a bit more, mm-hmm. since like they might not get things just by talking easily.
That's a good one. And often I find books really helpful for this, because
100%.
You know, putting these feelings or these situations on other people rather than it being like, we are moving house, let's talk about it.
Exactly.
More like, you know, how might this person be feeling in this situation? Because sometimes as parents we really don't have the language to navigate
100%.
This at all.
And I feel sometimes it makes sense when you see it happening or reading about it you know, someone else than you, mm-hmm. when you see something in front of you, like even a story, or like you're holding toys and pretend playing than talking about yourself, then it just makes more sense sometimes.
Gigi, what are some common signs that a child might be struggling with a new transition? And let's use, you know, going back to school after a long summer, which can be really, really challenging. Yeah. You know, maybe that child spent more time with their parents than they would do normally, yeah. feeling super, super attached, and then things change. And this, yeah. I'm talking about kind of neurotypical kids here. Now, when there's, you know, any kind of neurodiversity in place and routine, that can, you know, get you know, a little bit more complicated. But, you know, what should parents be looking for, and how can we recognize these signs early?
Definitely like a change of behavior. Like if they can tell that a change of behavior is obvious, that they're not their true self, maybe more of like separation anxiety with the parent. They're clinging more to their parents, to their mom and dad. Even like it can affect their social skills with other friends, with other people. Sometimes even their eating habits, their appetite. Because if you notice, like especially maybe with actually not just younger kids, like younger and older kids, maybe in the first few days of school, if they're still not used to it, they're probably going to eat a lot less. Mm-hmm. Like lunchbox wise, even at home, you know,
they're too busy chatting.
Yeah, right.
I didn't get enough time, and I was too busy chatting.
Exactly.
So change in behaviors, I think, is really crucial. Yeah. But then it's sometimes what I find hard is how long do you give it? How long do you say, okay, we just need to work through this for a few days, weeks, and then you get to like it's been months, and they're still not happy. That can be a really difficult decision as a parent to go, this just isn't working.
Yeah, which is why I think it's important to try to be patient and try to have a realistic expectation, because change can take time, but also it's okay to ask for help. It's okay to ask for support, either counselors, teachers, admin, if things got, you know, more severe, like coaches, therapists. It's okay to ask for help if you think, you know, things are getting out of control.
Mm-hmm. Shishi, you're doing now we hear a lot about like, you know, summer camps, football camps and tennis, multi-sports camps. You are doing a camp with a bit of a difference.
Yes,
which
true.
You said before about life skills, which made me think of kind of like a tiny child with a calculator making a budget or learning how to boil an egg. It's far more than that and very different to that. Tell us about what you're offering over the summer.
All right. So I'm running a life skills summer camp. And what that is basically is helping kids learn life skills such as emotional regulation, self-confidence skills, communication skills, more about, you know, how to stand up for bullying, how to be more kind, what is friendship, what are friendship boundaries, the power of their thoughts and their words. And it's all under a play-based method. So they're going to have fun while also learning and playing at the same time.
What age group would you say that's suitable for?
6 to 12 years old.
Okay. And where can people, I know I'm going to get messages asking where and when, so I'm just going to anticipate that now. Where and when, and how can people find out more?
Sure. So everything is on my Instagram at GG Kids Coach, but it's going to be at Kiani Wellness Center in Jumeirah. And starts July 8th until July 12th. That's the first week, and then the following week as well.
If anyone wants to send me the word life, let's do it that way, I will send you Gigi's Instagram account so you can find out more. I think this is a really big topic, and I feel like we've only kind of scratched the surface, but I think by thinking about what our kids might be going through when we're caught up in change, when we're thinking about, oh, which way am I going to drive to school, or I've got to go to the uniform shop, or I've got to, you know, pack for the, you know, the relocation company, or I'm changing jobs, or we're getting a divorce, and we're kind of so in our own heads about it, which is completely understandable, to have a bit of a pause and, as you say, really communicate and connect with our kids. Because, I think about it a lot, when we're able to have, you know, conversations that might seem like a little conversation to us, sometimes it can be a really big conversation to our kids. And like, that's where we need to kind of turn towards them in so many ways. Gigi, thank you so much. As I said, you're doing a camp over the summer. It's Gigi, so GIGI Kids Coach on Instagram. There is information about the Life Skills Summer Camp. If you could teach them to do a budget and boil an egg as well, it would be very useful.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Pleasure.
And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5pm.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.